I'm Miho Tanaka. I would like to extend my warm welcome to everybody who is participating in today's exciting cyber seminar. Today's seminar is the third presentation of our Innovation in Healthcare Informatics mini cyber seminar series. I would like to appreciate assistance from BIREC as well as the CIDR. And without their help, this cyber seminar series hasn't happened. And I am privileged to introduce Dr. Deborah Essen. Before her presentation, I would like to give you a little bit of background on her. Dr. Deborah Essen is a professor of computer science at Cornell Tech in New York City, where she has been founded the Jacob Institute's Health in Tech Hub. Her small data lab focuses on mobile health and small data, leveraging the pervasiveness of mobile devices and digital interaction for health and life management. Dr. Essen co-founded the nonprofit startup OpenM Health and was a founding director of the NSF-funded Science and Technology Center for Embedded Network Sensing at UCLA. Her hours include ACM Athena Lecturer and Anita Born Institute Women of Vision Award for Innovation and elected membership to the American Academy of Arts and Science and National Academy of Engineering. Today, Dr. Is going to talk about activating mobile health from smartphone apps and small data streams to behavior biomarkers. Thank you, Dr. Essen.
Hello, I'm hoping everyone can hear me okay and that somebody will tell me if they can't. I'm also hoping that you can see my screen. I'd love some confirmation, but I'll keep going. And if you hear some background noise, that's the bustle of New York City, some eight floors down in Chelsea, and I apologize, but I couldn't stop traffic for the seminar. Okay, so thank you again for inviting me, and I look forward to sharing some thoughts and experiences around building tools in an area that's a little different, that has more to do with personal health and small data, and that is not instead of, but very complementary to a lot of the big data initiatives. And, okay, in fact, in this second slide, right after the title slide, I just want to put this in context. If you think about a lot of the work going on in personalized precision medicine and the presence initiative in precision medicine as an example, there's a lot of very important work, ongoing work, a lot of work to do, a lot of progress having been made on what we can think of as really big data science, where people are doing a lot of exploration and discovery through analysis of electronic health records, of claims data, of conversations and discussions that patients have on websites such as Inspire or 23andMe or numerous other patient fora that you find out on the web. There's all the work that goes on in the context of not just genomics, but metabolomics and all the other omics, as we call them, in which analysis and analytics and algorithmic approaches to looking at data in the large have been really critical. So these are the places where computation and computer science and information technology have really been key and continue to be key to really important advances in this space. Where we work is in an area that I sort of call small data, in that instead of a focus which those other two pillars have, which is looking at data across large numbers of individuals. So it's big and large in the N, in the number of individuals whose data are being analyzed. We take a focus on what can you do by analyzing the data from an individual, but that data longitudinally and across many sources. So sort of N equals me or you or N equals one is what I mean by small data. And looking at data sources that I'll be describing to you that come from a range of mobile and digital trace sources. So that's what I mean sort of by small data science. One other point I want to make here before I go on to some of the details is a lot of focus in big data science is in fact on discovering previously unknown correlations, or in the context of genomics, since we know so little about what causes things to be in different components of the genome, you have no choice but to do broad scale attempt to discover that those issues. In the context of small data, while longer term there will be opportunities for discovery, we don't have to start there. We start with what is clinically known to be a relevant phenomenon or trend or response to be looked at, and we're just using this new source of information about that phenomenon. So if you're looking for somebody who's managing some inflammatory disorder that causes them to have reduced overall activity, then we look for using these all new sources of data like passive monitoring on their phone to look for indications of more of reduced and increased activity corresponding to the waxing and waning of those symptoms. If you're looking for somebody who is struggling with PTSD and you're looking to see if a new approach is working for them, then you can look for indicators that already the behavioral scientists and the clinicians know to look for, but now we have a new source of data to track it. So these this work can happen small numbers of individuals at a time because we know what we're looking for. We have a proxy that we're using the data for, and now I'll describe that in a little bit more detail. So we think of this N equals me or small data as having an opportunity to drive three really important feedback loops, if you will, of healthcare. One, if you look on the upper right, is when a patient is in treatment, and again, you could think about them as being treated for maybe chronic back pain that's a result of maybe injuries suffered while in service. And maybe it's as they approach middle age and put on additional weight that that lower back pain becomes quite severe, and they're now trying to manage how to best deal with that back pain through combinations of physical therapy, maybe trying to avoid surgery, maybe trying to avoid use or overuse of opioid-based pain medications. And in that context, it's a feedback process. They go to the clinician, they're given a prescription for physical therapy and medication. They're told to take as needed, but come back in some number of weeks to see how they're doing. And when they come back, there isn't a blood test that tells how much pain they've been in or whether their new regimen has helped them or whether, in fact, they had some particularly arduous week on the job that made their symptoms get worse, even though overall they're sort of doing better. And so I'm going to talk about types of data that could be captured automatically and used in a way to help to inform the clinician-patient conversation and the clinician decision-making that goes on, whether when the clinician is deciding, should I continue the course of therapy that they're on? Should I adjust their medications or their therapy? Should I give them different instructions? Do I have to change paths? Is there maybe something else going on there, et cetera? And you can replay that same story with a patient who is being treated for PTSD, for migraines, for COPD, quite a number of chronic conditions where it is an iterative process and there isn't a blood test or some straightforward physical biomarker that you can measure to give the clinician the clear feedback that they need. So another part of that story already indicated with the examples I gave, is that when the patient leaves the doctor's office, most of their time and most of the work of managing chronic disease is in the hand of the patient and their family. And so as the patient is figuring out, is Advil working for me well enough? Do I need the Percocet, for example? Or as the patient is figuring out whether their sleep patterns are really an important part of them being in good emotional state and managing some of their anxiety disorders. Whatever it is, that process, trying to figure out what triggers their migraines, the participant can get better information through apps that we build based on this kind of data that I'll describe. And then finally, a big piece of this story is also, what do we know? What do we know about how to treat people and what works for people and what works for different people? A lot of that is produced through large-scale randomized controlled trials, and then a lot of it is information that is shared very informally between people in a relatively unscientific way in terms of knowing whether, in a scientific way, doing X helps you with Y. And we have an opportunity through small data to drive improvements in all three of these things. The data that clinicians have to in their feedback loops of treating an individual, the data that an individual has about what is working for them, and the data that we have as a society and as a practice about what works for different individuals. And we've really never been in a situation and in a context before where data from individuals about day-to-day function and how they're responding to care has been available at such scale, and that's really because of the smartphone that has been so, you're hearing more of New York in the background, apologies, because of the smartphone that has been so broadly adopted across geographic regions, across demographics. It is the first point of access and many times the only point of access to internet and digital for lower resource communities. And so it's really been a very, it's provided an opportunity to us to think about how individuals can take care of themselves, be taken care of, and contribute to what is known in terms of research. So talking about the mobile health data that actually can fuel this process. And just before I lose some of you to disbelief, I want to make clear that I'm not assuming that people are all part of the quantified self movement. If you don't know about that, I suggest looking it up. I don't assume that people have the luxury or the time to sit there and study their data. So bear with me. I'm going to talk about some sources of data, and then I'm going to talk about how this data would be just automatically used by interesting applications and engagements. And that's the way that both clinicians and patients would experience the data, because neither clinicians who are treating many, many patients more and more with less and less available time, nor patients who are having to juggle many things, they shouldn't be expected to have a lot of time to stare at data. And that's not where I'm leading this conversation. Okay, but let me talk about the type of data that is going to fuel these applications. First of all smartphones now, it is very easy to just have an application that's downloaded on the phone that once somebody opts in, passively records their activity and location 24/7. And so activity and location, if you only get one data stream, is exceedingly rich in helping to inform the functional response of individuals in various contexts that we'll talk about more, and even some of the examples I gave, as you could imagine, as somebody is recovering from lower back injury, starting to do some physical therapy that is improving their mobility and reducing their pain, you expect to see them moving around more consistently, both just being more ambulatory and also probably leaving the house and having more standard and expected work hours and things of that sort. Beyond activity and mobility, again, if you only get one data stream, choose that one. Beyond that, there are all the other mobile apps that people use, which is actually why they have the phones and why they pay for their data plans and all of that out of their own discretionary budget. And those mobile apps, at the very least, are things like texting and various forms of text communication that are so widely used, again, across demographics and even age brackets, and other sorts of applications from maps, phone calls, and things of that sort. And it's also possible, again with opt-in, to capture data automatically that from which you can infer things around shifts in communication patterns, for example. I want to mention, and I'll be saying more about this, that it's not only the data from mobile phones. It's also something that we refer to more generally as digital traces. So when you're doing online purchases, maybe you buy some things from Amazon. Maybe you order food from groceries from Fresh Direct. Maybe you do some takeout ordering of dinners when you don't have time to cook from Seamless. Maybe you watch movies and even these TV series now that are produced and made available all at once, and maybe you even Netflix binge on Netflix, where you can just go from one episode to the next of those television series that in the old days we used to wait for week by week. Each time you do that, there is digital data recorded somewhere about your personal habits. And I'll talk more about some of the opportunities in being able to make use of those for individuals in addition, not instead of, the way that those things are made use of by the vendors themselves. And finally, there are, of course, quote, real sensors also. And so these might be physiological sensors, whether it's pulse ox, maybe it's a Fitbit or a Jawbone that basically does a similar thing to the activity data that you can collect on your phone, but maybe, depending on who you are, you like when you go out on your walks, you're more likely to use a Fitbit, or if you're trying to monitor sleep, you're comfortable wearing some kind of a band around your wrist that helps you to monitor sleep patterns. Maybe you're using Propeller Health's attachment to an inhaler that gets detailed information about how often an inhaler is used by the patient. These physiological measurements are important. Wearables are important. But I'll say two things. The main thing I'm going to say is they aren't more important. They're not more important. They're not more telling than these other data streams that we can leverage in personal healthcare. And the other thing I'll mention is just that they take a while to emerge. And so whether you agree with me that they aren't more important, you might well find yourself caring for populations, studying populations, or being part of a population in which the wearable you need doesn't exist. And so whether you agree with me that they're not more important or that you believe that they're more important but they don't exist yet, there's reason to pay attention to these other proxies for information about how the individual is doing. I also want to chime in here and mention that it's not all about passive data. There are still good reason and good context in which you want to ask the individual to offer up some information. But even in that context, the smartphone allows us to do better than the traditional text-based multiple choice fill-in question feedback. My favorite example of this is PAM, Photographic Affect Meter. It was developed by J.P. Pollack and Jerry Gay and a group of excellent researchers up at Cornell Ithaca. I will tell you that they did this before I came to Cornell, and I was a fan of this work long before I came to Cornell. And what you see in this picture is, in place of a standardized form for asking somebody about mood or affect, they came up with a visual approach to asking that same question. And the 16 images you see on this screen are randomized but not random. There's a whole collection of images, and each time you open the app to report on your affect, you see a different set. But the images are organized in a specific way to represent the two dimensions of affect. It's about positive and negative affect, if you look across the four vertical rows. And it's about, it's about high and low energy if you look from top to bottom, and it's from negative to positive if you look from left to right across the columns. So each of the quadrants, you can select an image, one of four, that represents your mood. And they have done detailed studies, they have publications on this that show the validity of this simple, interactive, engaging approach as compared with the standard PHQ-9, for example. And so this is important that it's about passive and it's about engaging ways of interacting with people through this rich visual interface that we have on smartphones. We're doing something that's been inspired by Pam in the context of pain, where we're adopting, instead of asking people in an abstract way to rate their level of pain on a scale, which is the standardized approach to pain. Give me a pain scale, whether it's a bunch of different levels of happy face to grimacing face, or whether it's a thermometer that represents the intensity of the pain. We're looking at this concept of activities of daily living, developed long ago and researched by many. And we took the idea of activities of daily living and PAM and said, can we look at an alternative way for people to report on their pain? And what we do is they have a quick engagement with a bunch of different photographs of activities. They select the ones that are their difficult activities on their bad days. What does their arthritis interfere with? What does their anxiety interfere with? What do their migraines interfere with? Their back pain interfere with? And those visual representations become their little personal buttons on their phone that they can tap to very quickly report on when they're experiencing pain interference. So it's not so much the specifics of this, although we'd love feedback on it or people who would like to try using this in studies or interventions, but it's getting helping you to get to think about ways in which we use this modern, visually infused world we have to both personalize and make more engaging how patients can generate data about their own condition. In the end, the really hard part of this problem that we have not begun to tackle is how you bring this data together and synthesize it and summarize it in a way that can be relevant to the feedback loops that I mentioned, particularly what's some kind of a data representation you can give to the clinician that will eventually pop up in the EHR, and when they're seeing their patient and they're looking at their latest lab work or anything else about them, they will see some representation of this data that tells them something. Has their walking actually progressed significantly so that they're generally walking much more on a daily basis? Not on any particular day, not counting the minutes, but how do we summarize it in a way that's relevant to them? In our work with clinicians to date, they are interested in pursuing some kind of a calendar view of what works for the patients. They want to be able to see multiple parameters at a time. Here, this is just an example that I consider an example of not having succeeded yet, but in which we're bringing together both what's the maximum walking speed of the individual on a daily basis, what's their active time in minutes, ambulatory as opposed to sedentary, and sitting in a car, by the way, is sedentary. In this context and is measured by the phone, and then more like in terms of their activities in the world, how much time are they spending away from home? Because that is something that also tends to be a reflection of overall function. Some other interesting data that's becoming available and innovations happening in this space, there's a startup called Paragon Measures, which is a startup here out of Cornell Tech, I should mention, not one that I'm directly involved with, where Yaron Levinson has developed really innovative analytics to detect from your touch screen tapping changes in dexterity that might be good measures for measuring, for example, progress of Parkinson's or response of Parkinson's to medication, possibly even things like the state of function for a rheumatoid arthritis patient who would be experiencing more stiffness in their hands and their joints of their hands over time, and in some cases could be relevant to looking at some side effects from medications that might cause reduced fine motor dexterity. Ginger.io is another startup many years more advanced, quite successful at this point. A great example if you want to sort of get a sense of where is this turning into product that's actually being used by health systems, I would look at what Ginger.io is doing. They leverage a lot of the data sources I mentioned, physical activity and location, communication patterns, and they've established their own proprietary algorithms for helping to detect, for example, when a type 2 diabetic patient might be entering a depressive episode and might be at risk for reduced adherence to their medication and dietary regimen that's so important for diabetics to keep as healthy as possible and avoid subsequent problems related to whether it's about foot sores or visual impairment or kidney disease, many of the things that are so important to type 2 diabetics to manage on a week-by-week and an ongoing basis. In general, the story here, the challenge here is the data sources we have, we can increasingly get to them. And the challenges are really, if you will, sort of moving up the information food chain. What's the right summarization and fusion of these continuous but noisy data streams? And how do we determine what's the right behavioral biomarker, the real measure of patient function, pulling out of these data, combining these data streams for different conditions and different individuals? And in this picture, what I showed at the top right is in different in various conditions now, clinicians have established these functional measures, such as a pegboard test, a timed pegboard test for Parkinson's, or a 6-minute walk for a COPD patient. And we need to generate the equivalent of those, and we need to do patient studies to verify them. And that's really where I'd love to, you know, call out to researchers and practitioners on this call and others whom you might know, because there we really need to broadly engage the clinical and the patient community to really leverage the power that the technology opens up, but by no means solves by itself. I mentioned that I see this data as being very empowering, but by itself it will do nothing. If we don't figure out, as I was just saying, how to summarize it in useful ways and verify valid markers for different conditions, clinicians will never be able to deal with it. It'll never become part of the way in which patients are treated. It won't become part of what the clinician sees in the EHR. We must solve that problem. From a patient perspective, in order for it to be useful for patients and for their self-management, and really, if you think about it, most healthcare happens outside of a clinical setting, and most of it is in the hands of patients and their families. How can we build applications that can know as much and be as useful to you as possible because they are informed by this data? It's great or not, but it's certainly the way of this decade that so many services are able to personalize to you because they know a lot about you, because they observe your experiences digitally. They can target advertising, and they can optimize recommendations because of that data. Can we similarly create applications that serve individuals because they are highly informed on an opt-in basis by those individuals' data themselves? Can we use it to build applications that will help us as individuals adopt and maintain aspirational health behaviors that will really make a difference for us in the medium and long term? So I must give recognition to what I think is the earliest example of a, if you will, a small data-fueled health application. And it's, I thought I got rid of all these things. I was trying to get rid of something and excuse that interruption. Anyway. The VA's PTSD Coach application, developed by a number of people at the VA. I know it through Julia Hoffman, who was core to its development and much of the mobility innovations that have been spearheaded by the VA and the DOD. PTSD Coach is a great example of an application. It wasn't developed to collect some study data for somebody. It was collected first and foremost to be a useful, clinically valid tool for patients themselves. So if you've been diagnosed with PTSD, you're going through the standard evidence-based course of treatment with cognitive behavioral therapy and such, this was envisioned and implemented and deployed as a tool so that individuals in between their appointments with their therapist have a tool in their pocket to help them manage their symptoms, find support, and do self-assessments to help them learn more about themselves and the progress that they are making in addressing how this impinges in their lives. And it's really, to this day, a really great example. Another really excellent example is by Tanzeen Chowdhury. She has a startup in this space called Health Rhythms, and they developed an early version of the basis for that called Mood Rhythm, which is, I love it as an example because whereas Ginger IO that I mentioned before is largely about data that comes back to the healthcare system so that the healthcare system can intervene with those patients who might be at risk of lack of adherence, Mood Rhythm, like PTSD Coach, was really is built as a tool for the patient themselves. So for somebody who's managing their bipolar symptoms, one of the standard of clinical care is to help people maintain, measure, and manage their daily routines. This has been done with paper and pen in journals. That's a standard of care. And what Mood Rhythm has done is they put it on a smartphone, and it makes the interface digital, alive, engaging, and always with you, but also it fills in a lot of data for you because it's not just an interface. It's not just a place for you to report things through an app. It also is with you most of the time, and it knows when you're sleeping and when you're awake and so forth. And so I think it's a great example of a small data-fueled application that's a tool that becomes really useful to the individual. And by the way, as with the potential for PTSD Coach and certainly with things like Mood Rhythm, some of the data that the person is using themselves is what can be synthesized down and summarized and relayed to their clinician. We're working on similar things in the context of chronic pain. I think it's a really excellent candidate for disruption, if you will, by these technologies, the opportunity to help individuals to find the combination of medical and non-medical, really behavioral interventions that are going to help them, whether it's the 7 minutes of exact stretches that you need to do to minimize your lower back pain on a daily basis. All it is 7 minutes, and it's 7 minutes that when you're in a hurry to get up and feed your family and get to work is 7 minutes that you might well decide not to take for yourself. And so building an application that helps the individual adopt that behavioral practice that generates data about how they're doing and shares that with a coach or a sponsor or a city health worker or a virtual coach for that matter eventually. There are many applications, and I think that pain management is one of the next ones to be addressed. Closing up so that I can take questions, just checking my clock, yeah. I wanted to finish up by talking about the way in which our small data traces beyond mobile can really open up this field over the coming years, and to emphasize some things I haven't mentioned so far. In particular, just to mention sort of what got me, I've been working in mobile health for quite a while, and what got me to start to think about small data was actually experiencing the end of my own parents' lives. They were both passed away close to the age of 90. They had very rich, wonderful lives, but as with what we all experience, aging, and particularly late-stage aging, is complicated and sometimes mysterious. And then Gert this isn't a picture of her, it's just a iconic, is a woman who I started with engaging with in a participatory design exercise around thinking about for a generation of people who aren't quite as attached to the mobile phone as even I am in my 50s and certainly as my students are in their 20s, that there are digital traces that people of all ages are generating, and how can we leverage those? And two in particular that I want to mention, is text communication, because many people who might not be avid mobile phone users have been using email for quite a while. And in email, we've established digital traces and records of our use of language over time. And so we have a very researchy project at this time looking to see that if you look over the past 10 years of an individual's email-based communications, with their permission, of course, and you're not literally, somebody isn't reading it, a program is reading it, to look for changes in language pattern use over time. And how might that be a, when we come up with the right analytics, how could that be used as a measure of cognitive performance, cognitive fatigue, and possibly even cognitive impairment over time? And you might use this clinically, but you might also use this to fuel a small data application again. So we have an example application that we built called Aura, and the tagline is to share how you're doing, not what you're doing. And this was really motivated in my interaction with the woman Gert I mentioned earlier, where it's all fueled off of your walking habits and where you spend your time and your email communications, but none of the details of that is shared. You don't share where you are with the few others who are sort of monitoring your Aura and they yours. You're just sharing a representation of how active are you relative to your norm. Are your communication patterns significantly different than your norm? And that's another example of the ways in which we're looking at using data streams that are really quite personal and in some sense too personal to share, but allow those things to be processed by an algorithm and a private piece of software so that you can share something automatically with whether, again, whether it's a coach or a family member that you're comfortable to share. I mentioned that we're looking at this in the context of aging and cognition. And finally, another example of this small data application is if there's one really critical driver to health for all of us, it's what we eat. And if there's a health-related behavior that's really hard to establish and even harder to, even after you start some healthier behavior, even harder to maintain in the context of the food environments we live in and our busy lives, it's around food. And we've built a system that explores this by using your receipts, automatically parsing those receipts and giving you swap suggestions on a week-by-week basis to help people, for example, once they've established better eating habits, having done the diabetes prevention program or something like that. This is a kind of technology piece that without any burden on the user, they don't have to fill out logs, they don't have to take pictures of food, can help to make swap suggestions and continue to support them in long-term healthy household grocery shopping. So just to close up, it's a really interesting time. So much is enabled by the availability of data. There are really interesting things now in play, both the research kit work by Apple in collaboration with Sage BioNetworks, in which they're really promoting a lot of broad-scale sharing of research data and enabling even larger scale research studies. And then the work that OpenM Health, a nonprofit currently funded by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, that really says, oh, it's fine we have these data, but we better turn them into specific clinical measures so that they can be used in studies, evidence created, and be used in care in a standardized modular way. It shouldn't matter what piece of hardware you're using. It shouldn't matter which app you're using or the app you're using this year versus next year. We need standardized ways of representing that data so that it can build and be used in standardized clinical care. And so I think with that, I'll just skip to the end. I will, if any of you are in the Bay Area, we're having an OpenM Health Summit next week, right before the QS Summit, and we'd love to see you there. A last bit of advertising, we have a health tech program starting up at Cornell Tech, a really interesting master's degree that basically gives is additional technical background for computer scientists with a real immersion in health and healthcare for their innovation. And, you know, send folks here who are maybe interested in that additional background, but it's also a great opportunity to collaborate with clinicians and with innovators because all of our students will be doing real-world projects, and they could end up prototyping your idea for you as one of their projects. So with that, I'll close and open it up to questions.
Can you hear me all right?
I can.
Great. So thank you so much for your presentation. We only have one question actually from the audience. Oh, a couple. I'll go through them now. So you mentioned that some of the data might seem too personal for patients to share. Are most patients willing to have their doctors or anyone really know when they're sleeping and when they're awake?
Thank you for the information. Thank you for the question. It's a great one. So let me I'll give you a long answer because it's a really important question. So it's patients, probably the patient-clinician relationship is the one that is most intimate, like literally. There are very few other relationships you can imagine that involve as much trust as a relationship between the patient and the clinician. So if you look just historically, it's quite remarkable how we put our hands, our lives in the hands of clinicians every time we engage. That being said, the detailed small data information I'm talking about is TMI, as we say in tech speak, right? It's way too much information to be shared, whether it's from a privacy perspective or whether it's from the liability and the clinicians don't have time to deal with that level of detail. So we don't share all of that detail. The opportunity, and that's what, and the challenge and the opportunity is to come up with the algorithms that will say, instead of sharing where someone has been or where they're sleeping or even how they're sleeping at all times, when you're looking into somebody having increased fatigue and you're wondering about whether it's sleep apnea or whether you're looking at somebody who just is not responding to some antidepressant medication and you're trying to understand, is there something else that's confounding the situation, a patient would opt in to sharing more detail for a certain period of time, and even then what they're going to share is some summarized statistics. If you look relative to their baseline, during a week or two when they're doing better, what are their behavioral habits overall, right? What's the average number of hours slept, or what's the time in which they go to sleep? So it's not about sharing all that detail. It's about sharing specific detail. It's not about sharing all information all the time. It's about sharing specific information at the right time when you're trying to solve a problem.
Thank you. How does privacy and HIPAA play into this?
So all clinical data that's being used in the context of clinical care needs to be stored in a HIPAA-compliant way. No problem. All these data, as they come into the clinical record, follow any other kind of data that you might do, whether it's checking your blood glucose if you're diabetic or checking your blood pressure. And so it's very important that any data being used in clinical care is stored and treated in a HIPAA-compliant manner. What was the thing aside from HIPAA? I forgot. Excuse me.
Just privacy and HIPAA.
Okay, so privacy I tried to address before, electronic health records and digital health records. There are a range of, a lot of work that's been done to make sure that the data is only available to the set of clinicians who should be given that data. There are all kinds of new efforts underway associated with giving patients even more control over their data, whether it's Blue Button or other approaches, and then giving them the way to securely store that data and share it in a selective manner. This isn't really different from that.
Okay, the next question. Can this also be used to capture IOM-17 psychosocial domains?
It's very applicable to psychosocial domains. I don't have that list in my head, and I can't go to Google on my laptop because I'm sharing my screen to quickly fill in, but I would say that's a very likely, at least partial, yes answer.
Okay. Let's see. Just scrolling through these questions. What do you suggest the research priorities are for demonstrating the health impact of these innovations? We know that more information doesn't always lead to better outcomes, yet it isn't feasible to test every app against health outcomes. Is there a framework for establishing which of these apps are most promising and what outcomes they have been assessed against?
That's the million-dollar question. So there's not one answer to it, and I think it's really important to pose it in the present and future tense, not just the past. Whatever health apps have been defined to date are just a drop in the bucket and really early, and probably we'll look back on them as very clunky versions of what will emerge. So we need a process by which we both establish what works for different people under different conditions now and going forward, and to realize that there are going to be a multitude of these things, not an infinite number, but some number of different approaches to apps and data as that feed biomarkers for different conditions. And we need to create an ongoing, you know, dynamic evidence base that helps to inform that. Now, with I think what we really need to get on board with now, and it's really we're behind in really bringing the level of care and tools that we could be giving to to our patient populations, is we need to take particular conditions and really go and do rapid pilots with the set of opportunities that are out there in systematic ways, and within the, you won't be able to say anything about long-running issues, maybe having to do with development of cancer or cancer survivorship or long-term mortality rates from something, but you will be able to say something about how does this approach help this population of people with PTSD, or this population of people who are comorbid type 2 diabetes and depressed, or this population of people who have chronic back pain and mild forms of depression. We can go after those populations and do focused studies with particular apps and data, have an ongoing cohorts that we do that with as new technologies emerge. And again, the sort of effort that Sage BioNetworks has promoted with its Bridge Network and what ResearchKit is about and what Google's Study Kit is about enabling the community to be doing, and on an ongoing basis, doing these cohort studies that let us know what is the best available of care. Very complicated question, and there's no one solution. And we can't just sort of do it and be done with it. It's about really changing the way we do our work and changing the way we do our research even.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, next question. Are there any major health plans adapting these small data apps and devices in delivery of healthcare? What are their level of interest and how far are they in terms of making that happen?
So, there are, and I think that Kaiser is a great example of one that has taken the lead on this and has really made a lot of progress. If you wanted to connect with one healthcare system, that I think is they're among the best. It's not surprising that they're an integrated healthcare system because you have aligned in one place the incentives of payer and provider. I would say the VA is another great example if you look at the work that they've done with their mobile tools that really, as I mentioned, for example, with PTSD Coach is a great example. I think that there are many other examples of it. If you look at the customers of Ginger.io, for example, if you look at the maybe the employer healthcare systems and other things that have engaged with new startups like Noom. But it's a little bit of chicken and egg because we have to create the evidence base so that the applications and commercial products out there can reflect them so that the healthcare systems can be changed. And everyone, I think, is starting to make more concerted efforts to move that forward, but it takes a while.
Okay. Have there been any discussions regarding data validity in some of the more passive data streams, such as sporadic use of mobile devices and multiple account users?
Yes, very much so. It's been there from the beginning. That conversation, it goes on and it has to continue to go on. I think in brief, which is what we have time for here, that you can think about it this way. Let's say that people up to maybe 30% of their time don't have their phones within an arm's reach. And there are two ways to think about that. You can think about that as, wait a minute, 30% of the time they don't have it on them. Or you can think about it as, for the first time ever, we have data from individuals generated automatically 70% of their time. And also, an important way to think about this is that, for the most part, I think the initial interventions and the big differences in impact is going to be on helping treating an individual over time. So you're not trying to say from that person's data whether they're developing Parkinson's. That's like far away. Stuff like that will happen, but that's not where the impact on care will start, in my opinion. The impact on care will start by saying, we now have a way of seeing that Joe Smith is responding well to this therapeutic approach to treating his Parkinson's better than he responded to some other therapeutic approach. So it's the person relative to themselves, and that is a problem that is more robust to whether that person always has their phone on them 70% of the time or 60% or 90%, because sort of they're that same person over time. And it's not about whether one day they forgot their phone. It's about whether in general every day when they leave the house, for the most part, they take their phone with them, and if they forget it, they go back and get it.
Okay. This next question is about ethics. Have there been any ethics discussions related to the potential financial pressures, opportunities for the companies gathering, storing this information to sell de-identified information?
Yes, there is a lot of such discussion, and on the same time, probably never enough. I think that if somebody's interested, I can, you know, point them off to some of the many discussions in that space. It is much, much bigger than just the topic I was talking about here. And again, I think there are many discussions of it, and at the same time, because it's such an important issue, never enough at the same time.
I'll go through a couple more questions. Would you say this is a system that leads to patient-centered care or individualized care?
Yes.
Okay. And one last question. What do you think about the direction of the small data research field?
I'll just use that, as we're often told, since it's the last question, to sort of just give a sum up that I think that while there's a lot of opportunity, I just would like to call out to the audience that is hopefully there to say that it's really making progress with clinical researchers and with patient groups to go ahead and build and test some of these apps together that is going to move something ahead. Because if we don't do the work to show in what form the data is meaningful to clinicians and in what form it's meaningful to patients, it will remain a more academic exercise.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Estrin. Before I pass things over to Heidi, I just want to let you guys know that the next session in this series will be presented by Dr. Holly Jimison. It is scheduled for July 13th, and it is entitled Making Sense of Sensory Data, the Big Data Challenges in Delivering Health Behavior Change Interventions to the Home. We hope you can join us for that next presentation. Thank you.
Great, and thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's session. As I close the session out, you will be prompted for a feedback form. We really do appreciate your feedback and hope you take a few moments to fill that out. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we hope to see you at a future session. Thank you.